Okay, welcome back to the Greg Kelly Podcast. It is a thrill to have this thing up and running, and we welcome our listeners from Brooklyn to Bahrain in the Middle East. Yes, we see where you're downloading and subscribing, and we appreciate it. If you feel like leaving a review, that helps us a lot as we are climbing up the Apple charts and wherever you get iTunes, Spotify, all that kind of stuff. It's terrific. I remain convinced that Donald Trump is on a trajectory to victory. This is a wild time. I feel like the energy is breaking our way. We'll get to some of that. But first, I want to talk about one of my favorite people as of late, Terrence K. Williams. All right, like a lot of you, I spotted him probably first on social media. He was a guy speaking truth in a very powerful and unique way. He caught the attention of the Trump family and then President Trump and Sean Hannity. And he is a comedian, a gifted performer, and a social media superstar. And this book is a real gem that I highly, highly recommend. From the Foster House to the White House, Terrence grew up with just about every disadvantage, at least on paper. But he also had some amazing gifts and an amazing relationship that is open to each and every single one of us, a relationship with God. And he protected him in the most magnificent way. And that, I believe, is available to all of us. But Terrence K. Williams, he was shining brightly on you. Congratulations on the book, and thanks so much. How are you?
Man, my brother from another mother. Thanks for having me on, Greg.
Thank you, Terrence. And so, look, this book is powerful. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know that much about you. And folks have seen you in the White House and praised by the president effusively, but you grew up in Oakland. And for a long time, you didn't even know who your dad was. And your mom, well, just tell us a little bit first, if you don't mind, about where you came from and what your mom was like.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Oklahoma City. I love my home state, Oklahoma. And my mother, she struggled with a crack addiction, and she had nine of us. I'm the fifth oldest out of the nine, seven boys and two girls, and we all did not have the same father, so there were six different fathers. And they were not in the picture, of course, and they were drug addicts also. And my mom was just unable to take care of all of us, you know, all by herself. And especially with dealing with a drug addiction, and she would, you know, she would fail to take care of us, to feed us, and to be there for us as a mother, because she put drugs and man before us. And not only did she have, you know, nine kids, a single mother with nine kids, my sister, my oldest sister at the time, she was 11 years old. She had her first child at 11, second child by 13.
This is Keisha,
so my
right?
My mother had, you know, yeah, Keisha. Yeah, my sister Keisha. So my sister Keisha had two kids by the age of 13. So my mother had all these kids, and then her kids having kids. And, you know, it was a pretty bad situation, and you know, and she would you know, she would neglect us and leave us with, you know, just leave us at home or with other people and not show up. And then eventually eventually we were all taken away by the system. So, and then from there, you know, I bounced from foster house to foster house to living in children's shelters.
Let me jump in for one second. Terrence, how old are you now?
I am 29 now. I just turned 29 in September.
So when did you realize as a kid that this upbringing of yours is unusual? Or perhaps, forgive me, maybe it was typical in your particular neighborhood or not as rare as it is in other neighborhoods, but when did it occur to you first, because, you know, this is all you knew for a while, that things weren't adding up, that this isn't a healthy way to live. This is not the way things should be. You know, a mother addicted to crack and all these other crazy things happening. When did that start to dawn on you?
You know, like you said, this was normal to me because all this started at a young age. I mean, I start in my first foster home. I remember starting kindergarten in my first foster home, but I was in the children's shelter before kindergarten. So, you know, this was normal to me for a very, very long time, being at my mom's and being with someone else and being here and being there. I didn't know. I mean, for a long time, I just, you know, it was my way of life. It was just my life, and that's just how it was. And I didn't know any better, but I knew that something was not right, especially when I, you know, started, you know, like as I got older, you know, going like living in a children's shelter, then, you know, being taken away, you know, like, you know, as I get older, you know, 12, 13, you know, I start to realize, you know, this is, you know, like this is not okay. And of course, I deal with you know, other kids like picking on me, calling me like a crack baby, and you know, making fun of me not having a home. So therefore, you know, so people, you know, so that's when I started to realize also is because other kids would make fun of it. So I knew, you know, that my situation was not normal, because I would see other kids with. Like with their parents, or when I'll be in school and people talk about like what their moms and dads do for a living and issues like that they're having at home. And I'm sitting back thinking like, I can't even get into this conversation with these people because I know nothing about having a mother and a father in a home.
Can I ask you this? You know, two things. Number one, you were you were a good student. You excelled academically, and school was kind of like a little bit of a break for you from, you know, the turmoil at home. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes.
What was your best subject?
School was always a getaway. School was a guaranteed meal too, you know. I mean, I did not miss the morning meal. I did not miss lunch. Listen, school was a guaranteed meal, and I got a free meal. Because I was one of the poor kids. So that's one of my favorite things about school was getting that free meal and getting away from, you know, reality.
And you started to notice, by the way, though, that it's in your book, and I don't know exactly how old you are, but you kind of make a distinction about what is your fault and what isn't. They're making fun of, you know, your upbringing, who your parents are, or not, you know, what they're doing. You kind of made a very mature observation that is not your responsibility. That's not your doing. Can you tell me like when you had, was that an epiphany? Was that a slow realization or was that all at once?
Yeah. You know, that was, it took me a while to realize that because, you know, as a kid, I really don't know, you know, I'm a kid. So as a kid, I did, you know, think about, is this my fault or, you know, like, is it me? Why me? You know, like blaming myself or, you know, but as I got older, you know, you start to learn it's not your fault. You know, it's my mom's fault. It's my dad's fault because they, you know, they failed to do their job as a parent because of their addiction. And, so I started to realize and like, you know what, some things are out of my control. And I think a lot of people need to realize that and accept that. And because when you do that, it makes you stronger and you move on from, you know, always blaming yourself, which is really, really bad. You know, it's bad for your health because that leads to depression. That leads to sadness. That leads to all kinds of things. But I knew it wasn't my fault. And after a while, and that helped me to cope and deal with the situation.
So, Terrence, I want to pause that for a moment. Just go to, we'll come back to that in a second. I want to go to where we are right now. You know, you have a relationship with the Trumps. The president knows who you are. He's impressed with your work. We don't know what happened on Election Day. It looks clear to me that this thing was stolen. It's not adding up, all kinds of factors. And I think that he's ultimately going to prevail. It may take a miracle, but quite frankly, miracles tend to follow this guy and they happen. So we'll see how this all plays out. What are you feeling right now? What's your mood like? I mean, are you anxious? Are you optimistic? You know, this guy has also been good for your career, good for my career, quite frankly. So what's this time like right now?
Well, so in the beginning, you know, on Election Day, the second day after election, the third day after the election, I could not sleep. I'm waiting on to see who's going to win, who's going to be the projected winner. I was losing sleep. And then when they wrongfully announced Joe Biden as the winner, my stomach dropped. I saw people dancing in the streets. I was watching videos on Twitter. People were dancing and I went to the store. People were, you know, on top of their cars, dancing, driving, waving rainbow flags. I mean, people were celebrating like we just got rid of a dictator.
Where were you? Where were you?
Dictator.
Where were you watching all this stuff? Where were you located?
I was actually in Los Angeles at the time. I was in Dallas. I was in Texas on Election Day because that's where I voted at, because I am a Texas resident. And then I went to a studio of mine in Los Angeles a couple days later, and I saw people they were acting a plum fool in Los Angeles. I mean, rainbow flags everywhere and dancing in the streets and twerking and I mean all kinds of stuff, and the police is not pulling these people over. These people are hanging outside their car window driving. You know, this is crazy. What are these people doing? You know,
but it made me sick to my stomach.
It made you. I knew they were stealing this election.
You knew it wasn't over. You weren't resigned to. I knew
it was not over. I knew it wasn't over. I knew it wasn't over. And I had a feeling that something like this was going to happen, because you have to understand that these Democrats they have been doing everything in their ability for the last 4 years to get rid of President Trump. And everything they have done has failed. They tried to get him on a false Russian hoax that was not real, this false Russian collusion crap. They couldn't get him on that. They could not remove him from office with their bogus impeachment. And now I knew that they were not just going to play a fair game with this election, in this election. I know they were not going to play fair, because they know that this man is a winner. President Trump, he was born a winner, and they knew this man was going to win. They saw the numbers. They saw his support. They saw that he was getting so much support from the minority community, the Black community, the Hispanics. I mean, more than any. I mean, he has gotten more support probably than any Republican president since Abraham Lincoln. You know, and they saw that, and I knew they were going to do something to cheat, but I didn't think that they would do it to this extent. I mean, they took it very far. I mean,
they may have taken it.
I knew they were going to rig numbers, but I didn't know they were. I didn't think they were going to rig numbers to. And I don't think President Trump, I think President Trump knew they were going to rig numbers, but I don't think he thought they were going to rig it to this extent. They went overboard. I mean, you have votes in counties where you have people that voted, they have more votes than there are registered voters.
They went overboard with rigging numbers.
They didn't give a damn.
It doesn't make sense in so many ways. I want to ask you this, though. I know from your book that you are a man of faith. I am a man of faith. You may be further along in your faith journey than I am. I am reading the Bible, but it is so much of it is new to me. I mean, it seems like you were in the Word of God as a child, and I was not. But putting that aside for a moment, as you know, God has a plan for everything. And I'm wondering, and tell me if this sounds crazy or whatever, but, you know, Donald Trump has been quiet for the past 3 weeks, or quieter than he normally is. You know, fewer public appearances. Yes, he's active on Twitter, maybe not as much. And you know that from adversity, great things can come. Growth happens. Do you think that this opportunity, this lull that's before us, is a moment for the president? Like, perhaps God would like to see some growth, some change, some... Look, I love the guy. I do. I want him to be reelected. I like his style. I like his policies. But that he wants to do something even more in his life. And this is a time that he has created, he meaning the Lord, to promote growth, to give him a rest, to, I don't know what exactly, but something is happening. That this as well, even though we believe thievery is involved, that this too is part of God's plan.
Yes, you know what? I believe that God is going to show President Trump that he is real. And President Trump is aware that God is real. President Trump is a Christian man, you know. He believes in the Lord, you know, and he acknowledges, you know, God. He acknowledges Jesus. So we all know that. And I believe that President Trump realized that, you know, listen, I believe that he's been thankful for what God has done for him, especially since the day he stepped in office, because that was, I don't think President, listen, now, President Trump had a lot of optimism about winning in 2016. We all did, because I voted for him, and I voted for him in 2016 also. But another part of me was like, I don't know if he's going to win, though. I don't know, you know. And I don't, you know, so he knew, but he didn't know. Now, so that's all God right there. That was all God. And I do think that he's really going to appreciate the Lord, because this is God's plan. I believe, I really do believe that, Greg. This is God's plan, and he's going to show President Trump that, you know, he is with him. And I think that this may also bring Trump closer to God, because this is a lot. Dealing with COVID stuff, that's a lot on a president. Dealing with this election being stolen from him, this is a lot for a president. I don't think no president has been treated like this. God is all President Trump has right now. Everybody is against this man. Almost everybody in D.C. is against President Trump, even Republicans. I mean, people are stabbing this man in the back. People are, I mean, these Democrats have been ruthless for the last 4 years. President Trump don't know who he can trust. He don't know, I mean, who he can talk to. He just don't know. I don't think he really, you know, because these people are so corrupt. It is. I mean, the swamp needs to be drained.
Yeah, you put a video
he
out.
He has to lean on God.
You put,
because, Greg, I'm gonna tell you this.
Yeah,
God, listen. God will take everybody from you, everything from you, and for you and. He can take everything from you, your mother, your brother, your sister, your cousin, everybody. But you will have him at the end of the day, and he will show you that. And I think, you know, God is showing President Trump that, you know, that he is all that he has is God, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I really do believe.
I'm with you on that. And, you know, you said something about how there's very few people he can trust. You put a video out a couple of days ago, maybe a few days after Election Day, about all the Republicans who should be out there fighting for him. Now, there are a few. There are a handful. Jim Jordan immediately comes to mind, congressman from Ohio, great guy. But, you know, the establishment really, both Republican and Democrat, would breathe easier if he were off the stage. I think that, and I don't think people in the media appreciate that, or maybe they do. People in the public don't appreciate how much his own party has been working against him in big ways and small.
Yeah, you know what? This is my thing here. And see, Greg, a lot of people came at me talking about, oh, Terrence, you can't be acting like Trump helped all these Republicans and they don't have to stand up for him and this and that. No, yes, they do. Yes, they do. Because a lot of these Republicans rode on the coattails of President Donald J. Trump. President Trump went out and rallied for a bunch of these people and they won in landslides because of his support. The polls showed it, everything showed it, all the statistics showed it, because President Trump got out there and rallied for some of these Republicans is the reason why they won. Some of these people were doing really, really bad in their numbers until President Trump stepped up. Now that President Trump is in need, now that he needs the support of everyone, they want to disappear because they got what they wanted. That's not right. That's not right. And President Trump is loyal. This man, everybody knows that. Even CNN know that. Even MSNBC know that. They always talk about it. President Trump, oh, he has to be loyal to all his friends and give his friends jobs. And he always has to be loyal to his friends. President Trump is loyal. And I know that this man is so disappointed in some of these Republicans. I know that he's disappointed in a lot of people that he has helped. And listen, when President Trump helps you, he's not looking for anything in return. But you know what? When somebody helps you, you know what you should do? You probably should help them, too, when they are in need without them asking. You know? Like, why wouldn't you want to? Somebody has been there for you, you know? And then not only are they letting him down, they are letting us down, the American people, because we trusted these people. We voted for these people because we thought they had our back. We thought they were going to put America first. Joe Biden is putting America last. Trump is putting America first. So if you are all about America first, you need to be supporting President Trump. If you don't support him, then you don't support America, because you are allowing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to steal this election, and we all know they are going to drive this country into a ditch.
Wait a second, Terrence. Hold on. Joe Biden told me he's going to fix systemic racism. And Joe Biden, 78-year-old Joe Biden, who's been in power since 1972, over the past, 6 weeks, has decided that systemic racism is his platform, which I think is totally ridiculous. I mean, that a guy like him, even what do you think? And I should point out to our viewers, if they don't know, if they're not familiar with your work, I am a Caucasian man, and Terrence Williams is a black man, and yeah. I think you get some heat from liberal quarters because you hold the views you do, and they say that a black man should not think the way you do. And we can get into how utterly contemptible such a worldview is, that you're supposed to think one way because you look a certain way. But just first thing, Joe Biden says he's going to fix systemic racism. To me, that's a bit of a joke.
Listen, first of all, Joe Biden can't even fix his dentures, okay? First of all, Joe Biden, the only thing he wants to fix is his son's laptop, okay? That's the only thing he's worried about fixing. His son's mess. Joe Biden has been in office over 40-something years. This man had 40 years. You had a lot of time. You had a lot of opportunity to fix racism. You were the vice president. You were Barack Obama's vice president. Why you and the first black president, why did y'all not get anything done for the black community? The first black president sat on his narrow behind and did not do anything for the black community. And Mr. I'ma Fix Racism didn't do anything either. Because you know what? They don't care about anybody but themselves. They don't care about the black community. They don't care about the white community, the Latino community. They don't care about Americans, period. All they care about is themselves. That's the only thing Joe Biden care about. And this man supported the 1994 crime bill and bragged about it. Now he's apologizing because he wants to be the president. This man, President Trump, has done way more for the black community than the first black president. Now, Greg, how does that make any sense? People voted for Barack Obama because he was black. Black people voted for him thinking that he was going to do a lot of things for them. Black people voted for Barack Obama because they thought he was going to put the black community first. They thought he was going to help them. They thought that Barack Obama was going to bend over backwards for them. Barack Obama didn't do nothing. He didn't do nothing for the black community. President Trump has done way more for the black community, way more than the first black president, and Joe Biden, and Hillary, and Bill Clinton, and all the Democrats put together. How in the world does that make any sense at all? If President Trump is a racist, why has he helped more black people than the first black president?
It's pretty wild, man.
Now, make that make sense.
I can't. And, you know, you see Obama now. I'm surprised. I've said this before that, you know, he's having a great time, obviously, making a lot of money. He's going to be a billionaire. I'd love to see him go to Chicago and break up the gang warfare that's happening there. They would listen to him. They would respect him. And he'd have to put it on the line, though. And I don't think he's that kind of guy. I don't think he puts much on the line for anybody else other than himself. Sorry about that. That's how I feel. Listen, Terrence, so back to your upbringing around Oklahoma City. At some point, all right, things get rough. The situation with your mom is tough, neglecting you. You're hungry. You're living in squalor. The state ultimately finds you a great foster family known as the Solomons, the Solomon family, and you had a great time there.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I love the Solomons. Rest in peace to John Earl Solomon. He died back in 2009. They were a great family. You know, they taught me a lot of wisdom, and I was with them for a while.
How long? How long about?
They were not. You say what?
How long?
Oh, man. I say probably about a couple few years, I believe.
Few years.
Listen, I was in kindergarten when I started kindergarten at home. So I was pretty young, you know. And since I started out in the system so young, you know, I may be off, you know, with the timelines a little bit. I may be off maybe a month,
no,
or
I
six
see.
Months or 4 months because I was so young, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I was so young.
Can I ask, the Solomons take you in. And you made an observation in the book that's interesting. You know, foster parents, foster kids. There are a lot of foster kids out there. I quite frankly never hear about fostering. You hear about it only in a negative context in the news. It's something I almost never hear about, except when something goes wrong. Yet every time I put on television, I mean, you can't watch TV for more than a half hour without seeing some PSA or commercial for some charity or organization that's doing good work protecting dogs and cats. And that's great. Dogs and cats, I love them. But it wasn't until I read your book that you pointed out that dogs and cats in America get a hell of a lot more attention than foster kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And listen, I love my pets, okay? I love dogs and I love cats. I love rabbits and everything else, okay? Turtles too. But I feel like sometimes people care more about the animals than they do about the children. I mean, I know people who donate millions of dollars to animal foundations to save a whale, to save a sea turtle, you know, and they live 1,000 years, you know. But when it comes to helping children, a lot of people don't want to donate a toy. They don't want to donate a can of beans. They don't want to donate a jacket, a t-shirt, some socks, or anything. Not a dime. And I just don't understand why. You know, these children matter, too, in this country. Every living thing in this country matters. Every living human being matters in this country, you know. And I think we should start putting our children in this country first. You know, a lot of countries, they put their children on a pedestal. They put the elders and the children on a pedestal, and they take good care of them, you know. And I think we should do the same in this country. These are our neighbors. These children are down the street from us. Why are we driving past them to go help children, to go help people in Africa? Why are we driving past these homeless children in our neighborhoods? Why are we driving past them to fly out to India to go help some couple there who needs a house?
It's great.
Children in your own neighborhood who needs help.
So, yeah, it's a great point. It's in the book, and it really made me stop and think. The book, again, is From the Foster House to the White House. Terrence, I want to honor your time, so let me get through a couple of things here. Fostering worked out in some places great. The Solomon family, they were very, very good to you. Then the Scarborough family, total witch, nasty, brutal person. But without going into detail, unless you want to, but can you talk a little bit about how you believe that you were protected every step of the way? That, you know, even though it was, you had a lot of hardships, you didn't have a lot, and you had to put up with a lot. This all kind of worked out according to a grand plan that the Lord had for you.
Oh, most definitely. And I believe that God was with me the whole entire time. And I believe, you know, listen, I went through, you know, abuse. I've been through so much pain. I dealt with so much pain. And I realized later on in life, after I started talking to other foster kids, and some foster kids would tell me, hey, Terrence, if I didn't hear your story, I would have committed suicide, but you have helped me. So I thought to myself, well, maybe I went through all of this. Maybe this was God's plan for me to go through all of this so that I could be strong enough to help other people. Because now, people that come from my situation, they look up to me and they look to me for advice. And I've been able to inspire and to motivate, you know, and to just help, you know, kids and young adults who were just struggling mentally and didn't know where to go, didn't know who to trust. And the fact that I've been through what I've been through, I'm able to help them. So I was built for this, and that I believe that was God's plan, you know, because I used to ask myself, why me? Why I got to go through all this? Why me? And now I think to myself, now I believe that I went through all of this just so that I could be able to make a change in the world, to make a change in other people's lives. And I wouldn't take any of it back. I wouldn't change anything if I had the chance.
It's beautiful, man. Look, I got to go through a couple of things. Number one, you're a good student, and you know, you're back and forth with your mom. You're doing well in school. You like to make people laugh, and that becomes a real tool for you. I want to ask you, though, you go to college, a small college. What was it called? Rose State or something like that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Rose State.
Why didn't you? And you didn't like it. You decided it wasn't for you. What happened there?
You know what? I'm actually good at school, okay? I'm very good. I've always made great grades. But inside of me, I've always wanted to entertain. I always wanted to, you know, make people laugh. And I enjoyed making people laugh, making other people happy. And, you know, one of my professors, one of my teachers that told me once, it was like, she told me, she said, Terrence, she said, you know, I normally don't tell students this, but you would be wasting your time behind a desk. Your personality needs to be in front of the world. And that really, you know, struck a nerve. And because I love entertaining, and I decided, you know what, I'm going to chase my dreams and not do what other people tell me I should do. You know, Terrence, you should go to college. Terrence, you can't, because a lot of people will say, you know, listen, you cannot make it in the entertainment field because a lot of people don't make it, and there's only a few in this world that will. And, you know, so you need this. And I understand it's coming from a good place. But I decided to, you know, do what I love to do. And I dropped out of college.
You dropped out of college instead of going to...
I dropped out of college, and I decided to chase my dreams of being a comedian and doing acting. And then somehow I ended up in politics.
Well, you went to Austin instead of Hollywood.
That was never the plan. I never thought about doing politics. I never thought about talking about politics. That was never the plan at all. Now I've always watched the news and stuff and kept up with stuff, but I never thought I would be commentating about, you know, political issues and stuff like that, and social issues. I just wanted to laugh and clown around. But I ended up, you know, in this political world, which is very toxic. Oh my goodness! And that's why I continue to laugh and try to have fun, because man, oh, politics are so toxic. It is. I mean, it can be so depressing and so. I mean, the political world can be very, very black. It can be a very, very black world, and that's why I try to bring some light, you know, with my comedy.
Well, even when you're bringing light with comedy, and your videos are outstanding, they can bring on, well, as you know, a lot of negativity. You can put something positive out in the world, and a lot of negativity is going to come back your way. That's part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that happens. Definitely. But can I ask you this first? Like, the videos that you put out, which are brilliant and captivating, I'm curious, like, and you look, let's face it, you're associating with the highest level people around. Two questions. Number one, can you monetize these videos? I'm not asking yet. Like, is it easy? Not easy. Nothing's easy. But do these videos make you money?
These videos can make me money, but Facebook and YouTube, they can't make any money on Twitter at all. But I was once not... I could, you know, there was a time I was able to monetize on videos, and I was cut off because of my political views, and they said that I was breaking community standards and all this crap, and I'm like, what? So, you know, I may make $5 on a YouTube video. It's pretty ridiculous, you know, and Facebook, they banned me from even advertising. They banned me for advertising. From advertising. I can't even advertise my book on there. They banned me for 30 days because they said I had broken too many community standards, too many community rules.
Did they cite any specifics? Like, what, how do they justify that?
All fact checking. And listen, I like to do live videos. So they would say I broke guidelines in some video, they would delete the video. I don't even have the video saved. I can't even watch it because it was a live video. And I just did that just, you know, off the cuff. And I, like, can I watch it to see what I said wrong? Are y'all not going to tell me? I reached out. They can't tell me anything. They just said, you know, I was fact-checked or I broke community guidelines. Well, fact-checked on what? You know, like, what is the fact-check? Where is it at, you know? Sometimes they let me know, sometimes they don't. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, they fact-checked me the other day when I said that Joe Biden had 1,000 viewers on his during his Thanksgiving speech. I said he had 1,000 live viewers, at a point. Yes, he did have only 1,000 live viewers at a point during his speech. I didn't say the whole speech. I said at a point. Like, I mean, so they take that video down.
That's crazy. And you know what? It's so dangerous. And now I liken it to, you know, the guy who invented the telephone, Alexander Graham Bell. Imagine if he only allowed people to have a phone whose conversations he agreed with. I mean, that's the kind of situation we're in right now. I mean, the phone company started as a private company. Thomas Edison, I think, was a private company. And then they became quasi public, private, whatever. I just think something this big, this powerful, social media, you can't allow Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg to figure out whether or not they like your content. And if that's the way it's going to be, I think it's too big to leave in their hands. And I don't know if that's there's any way to make that happen, but I can't. It's totally ridiculous what's happening to you. I think it might be happening to me in more subtle ways. And it's terrible.
It's very terrible, and it's not fair at all. It's really unfair. I don't hear any Democrats dealing with this stuff. I don't hear any liberals complaining about being censored. It only happens to conservatives, to people who support President Trump. It's ridiculous. It's unfair. I feel like we are being targeted. I feel like I feel like this is basically segregation, you know? I mean, they want to segregate us, you know, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. They don't want us eating at their rest. They don't want us eating at the same place as them. They don't want us, you know, being in the same building as them. They don't want us being on the same platform as them. You know, that's segregation.
I never thought of it that way. No, you're that's a form of segregation right there, man.
That's a form of segregation.
Hey, can I ask you
it's
about
ridiculous.
It is totally crazy. But there's one day, you tell me the year, but you're on your lunch break and you're scrolling, I guess, through your phone and you see something on Facebook that gets your attention and you decide to do a little Facebook Live video right there.
Oh, yeah.
What?
So that was in July of 2016.
2016, you went viral without even really trying.
Yeah, I went viral. Man, listen, that was my first time making a live video. And I was scrolling through Facebook, and I saw a bunch of my friends talking about, let's move back to Africa, it's time to go back. And I'm like, time to go back? And see, this is when the Facebook Live was, I think the Facebook Live wasn't really popular because they had just started doing it, really, you know? And I said, you know what, let me try this thing out. Let me talk about this real quick. And I only had probably about 1,000 followers. Those are people that I went to school with, you know, people that I, you know, work, people that I used to work with and that I work with. And you know, so it was, you know, just family and friends and stuff like that. So it was only 1,000 people. This video, I mean, went super viral. You know, like over 7 million views in a day. I was like, oh my goodness, I couldn't even believe it. And, but the, you know, I was like, hold on, what y'all mean move back to Africa? I've never been, so I'll be here when y'all get back. Let me know how Farrakhan treats y'all. And I was like, shoot, listen, I don't know why y'all want to move to Africa anyway. And when you half of y'all are crying and complaining about health insurance, well, I hate to break the news to you. But they got flies out there that will kill you. Your health insurance ain't paying for that. So I don't know why y'all want to move to Africa. Now, listen. Now, I was making, you know, and they talking about, oh, we was kings and queens, and they kidnapped us in slavery. They know, but no, they did not. No. I said they pay cash. It was, listen, I said, I was basically saying in the video, you can't be mad at one party. You got to be mad at two parties. It was called the slave trade. It takes two parties to make a trade. It takes two people to make a trade, okay? So you can't be mad at one. Be mad also at the people who sold you into slavery. And first of all, I get sick and tired when black people are saying, we was kings and queens. No, we were not. Our ancestors were not kings and queens. They were peasants. They were slaves. They were slaves that were sold to the Europeans. They were already slaves before they got to America, okay? They were already slaves. They were captured slaves or whatever they were. They were already slaves before they came to America. The Europeans did not go over there and kidnap all these people. Now, maybe some tried one day, but it didn't work out. Because, listen, I mean, the Europeans did not want war with the Africans. I mean, these people run. They were running with hyenas at the time. I mean, they, you know, I'm not, like, I wouldn't even fight anybody that's running with hyenas, you know? These people having dinner with lions. So, I don't think the Europeans weren't that stupid. You know, they were not that stupid.
All right. So, we can see why you went viral. I tell you what, man. Look, I want to ask you.
Sarcasm. Come on, man. These people, you know, listen, so I was using a bunch of sarcasm, though. But, you know, I was having fun, but also, you know, dropping the truth on these folks.
Well, that's the thing. You're like Trump in a way. You say things, they sound wild and over the top at first, but there's often a kernel of truth, or actually more than a kernel. There's a foundation of truth, and it's very, very effective. You know what I mean? Like, he just kind of comes in. It seems outrageous at first, but then everyone's like, well, maybe he's got a point there, doesn't he? Even those who disagree with him.
Exactly.
So, look, I want to ask you about Keisha, your mom. She ultimately, in the book, she kicks drugs, then she gets hooked on alcohol, but then she kicks that, and she went back to school. Last I read, she was going for her nursing degree. How is she? Where is she? What's going on?
Well, so she has her associates, and I believe she's now working toward getting her bachelor's, which is pretty good. So she's doing very, 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 very good. So that's a good thing.
Is she impressed? She must be like, look at you. I mean, look at my boy here. This is incredible.
Yeah. So my mom called me and said, you know, I'm so proud of you and stuff like that.
Oh, and forgive me. I called your mom Keisha. Your Keisha is your sister.
So Keisha is my sister.
So tell me about
Keisha is my sister.
Where is she? What's she doing?
So Keisha is right now. She's helping her daughter take care of her kids. She's working. I don't know what job. I don't know what kind of job she has right now. I think she has a new one, but I know she was like doing like some, you know, help. She was doing something in healthcare the last time I talked to her. You know, helping with taking care of elderly people. But I don't know what she's doing now. I think she has a new job. But Keisha's doing great. She is doing really, really great, and I'm proud of Keisha.
She did a great job.
She had a very tough life, you know. Keisha had a very, very tough life, you know. And, you know, I talked about her a lot in the book, and I didn't go, you know, and there's some stuff that I did not talk about, you know, because, I mean, the book would have been probably 1,000 pages. But Keisha had a tough life. I said, Keisha, you need a book you need to write a book. But now she wants to, in the last time I talked to her, actually I remember, she wants to start a nonprofit to help young girls, young girls and women who may have, you know, been in the streets, and young girls that are heading down the wrong path, and also wants to, you know, prevent young girls from heading down the wrong path also. Because, you know, like I said, she had two kids by the age of 13.
Yeah.
You know, Keisha, you know, there was a point in her, she ended up, you know, getting into drugs too at a time. But I think, well, she started selling drugs at one time, and, you know, a lot of stuff, prostitution stuff. I mean,
yikes.
Because she was on her own. You know, she didn't go to the foster care system. She had left with her two kids at the age of 13, and she didn't finish middle school. So
it's
she
tough.
Doesn't even have a middle school education.
Yikes. Terrence, I do have to ask you about this, and I find it interesting. You know, people, if you just sit back and listen to the mainstream media or even social media, if you glance at it, you know, you can go out on television and say Donald Trump's a racist, the family's full of racists and crooks. You can say that on CNN and not be challenged. You can get away with it. And you can be, you can hear that message all the time. And I found it very interesting. Number one, you developed you know, some contacts within the Trump world. Lara Trump started following you on social media. Donald Trump Jr. and people like that. Anyway, you go to New York. You know a lot of people. You're kind of you're rising in social media, and you reached out to a few people. And I think the only ones who really wanted to see you and make time for you were the Trumps. And I just kind of found that pretty wild. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, the discrepancy between what they say about the Trumps and how they actually treat people?
Well, yeah, first of all, what the media is telling people is all bogus and lies. They have never met the Trumps, most likely, because if they knew the Trump family, they would not be saying those things about them. President Trump and his family are so real, so genuine. These people, I mean, are so down to earth. And like I said, when I went to New York City, there were so many people out there, you know, that I thought that wanted to meet me. And, you know, and they used my platform. They wanted me to share their stuff on my Twitter page and Facebook. And you know, these, you know, were people, you know, that I thought that wanted to meet me also. They said, when you come, like, you know, come on out. I put you on my TV show. I'll do this. I'll do that. Nothing. I didn't hear nothing from them. And I gave them plenty of time. And I mean, I reached out in advance. Nothing. Laura Trump and Lynn Patton, I reached out to them, and they did not let me down. I was going to say they are men of their word, but these are women. they were the only ones who took the time out. Laura Trump and Eric Trump, you know, so kind. And I mean, we went out, we had, you know, I went out to the Trump Tower. She invited me to the Trump Tower. You know, we actually, you know, I think I saw them for 2 days in a row. It was pretty nice. You know what? We didn't talk politics or anything. They didn't ask me for nothing. They didn't tell me to do anything. They didn't, you know, I mean, it was cool. I was like, wow, they are so down to earth. It's very, very, very nice people. And President Trump is, I mean, that guy right there is incredible. And Greg, I think I'm going to have to fight you, man, because listen, President Trump, man, he used to retweet me all the time, but now he's starting to retweet Greg Kelly all the time. And man, you can't be taking my Trump away from me, man.
It's pretty wild. It's wild when it happens, and it's kind of surreal. And let's face it, any other president, only this president. And there are many reasons why I want him to stay in office for the good of the country, for the good of his the world. But also, quite frankly, I think, look, it's all in God's hands, of course. But, you know, I don't expect to have this kind of rapport with any president in the future, nor do I particularly want one. So it's an amazing kind of surreal moment.
Very
when that
amazing.
Happens. Yeah. Hey, man, I could talk to you for another hour and a half. I want to respect your time. And I want to tell everybody again, this book is a real gem. I highly, highly recommend it. From the Foster House to the White House, the journey of Terrence K. Williams. And actually, forgive me, but I got two very, very quick questions. Mr. Solomon calls you Clarence in the book, not Terrence. Maybe you explained it and I missed it. Why does he do that?
Oh, because he just never could get my name right. he was an old guy. You know, this man was like born like, I think like in the 20s or something. This guy, he was an old guy. So, you know,
the other thing is,
couldn't get my name right.
I get it.
Yeah, that's it.
You talk about, you have a familiarization with the Bible as a young man, and the Bible has become very important to me in recent years, and the most important thing to me. However, it's a big mysterious book. People don't know how to tackle it. It seems daunting. And I have a version of it that has footnotes and explainers, the Charles Stanley version that I like a lot. But my question to you is, if you care to answer, if you know, like, what is your approach? Do you read it every day? Do you read it once a week? Do you not need it anymore? I mean, like, honestly, like, how do you approach the Bible?
Well, I have to be honest. I do not read the Bible all the time at all. You know, when I was growing up and when I was going to some of these foster homes, like the Solomons and other foster homes, you know, they were all church going people. So, there was a time I knew everything. I mean, I could tell you every single I knew quote from quote, word from word. But I'm so familiar with it is that, you know, I really don't need to read it every day because I know the Lord and, I know what he's all about. And, so
I understand.
I don't need to read it every day because he is in my heart and I know what's right and I know what's wrong and I know much of it already. And sometimes I will go listening to I will listen to, you know, pastors and preach instead of reading the Bible sometimes because I know the Bible already, you know. So but if I want to go back and I may go online and read some. Like some scriptures, you know, that I, you know, wanted to read again, you know, the ones like that I like and stuff like that. But not every day.
So I'll just offer this. You are much further along in your faith journey than I am. I did not have, and I don't know as much about the Bible as you do, even though today I'm reading it every day. I did hear this recently, though, from a Pastor Charles Stanley on a podcast. He said he still reads it every day, and every day he still learns something new. It's this document, living document, and it's a conduit really for him to speak to us. I got one tip, again, not in person, and I've been looking for the right plan to approach it. This is the best one I have so far, and it was a random comment I heard from Denzel Washington of all people. And he said, I just try to read a couple of pages a day. And that's what I've been sticking with. I wonder if I need a more formalized plan. But hey, man, that's another podcast. I really appreciate Terrence K. Williams. Check him out all over the place on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And the book, again, available wherever you get books. You can download it and have it in your iPad or phone in about 8 seconds. From the Foster House to the White House. Just an amazing moment. And Terrence, I really appreciate it, pal. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, brother. I really appreciate being on. Looking forward to coming back on.
Will do. Will do. Stay in touch. Thanks, buddy. All right. There he was. I like the guy a lot, and I think he has a lot to offer and a big future. And the book, again, how faith and God guided him through those horrible times, treacherous, just people in his life, some evil people, some good people who are making bad decisions too. And look at him now. I think the sky is the limit. A true leader in America right now, Terrence K. Williams, and an independent thinker and leader. Independent, truly. All right. Thank you very much for listening. You can go to, if you would, it would be great, rate the podcast, subscribe to it. I want to thank our listeners all over the world now. They're everywhere, every continent except Antarctica, I think. So appreciative. And what else? And I'll see you on Newsmax at Newsmax on 7 p.m. East Coast time at Greg Kelly USA. You know, one thing I'm going to really follow up on, it was interesting how we said, and I love dogs and cats. I grew up with a dog, but every time I turn TV on, I do see one of those commercials, and they're great, valuable cause. No one should take anything away from that. But where is the support for foster kids? I know it's out there, and I know there are groups working to help those, but gosh, you don't hear about it as much, do you? As much as the dogs and cats. Thank you, everybody, and see you next time.